This is Roger Tuft, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 12th of April, 2011. Roger Tuft, Part 2.
Did you ever do anything which in retrospect was a bit silly in the Antarctic? Did you take risks which perhaps you wish you hadn't done?
I think yes, probably looking back at it. There's two incidents completely different. Well, I was talking about Hope Bay and the Argentinians. Like good Brits, of course, we were very superior about the Argies and saw them as a cloud of deference, particularly as they had no Antarctic history as far as they were concerned. Well, when it was good weather, from time to time, we put a new sheet of tarpaulin on the roof because it soon got battered by the winds and so on. And we often used to sit out and sunbathe. And the Argentinians, who were down below us, about a mile, I suppose, not much more, they used to do similar. You'd put chairs on the, like that chair. And we were messing about, as I say, doing some outdoor work, which was useful. And at the same time, we were getting water and what have you. And we noticed there's a bit of a hubbub down at the Argentinian base, and somebody remarked on it and said, there's something going on down there. Now, this was, by this time, it was sort of early afternoon. And we weren't particularly worried. And they saw somebody coming up the hill towards us, and it was one of the Argies, of course. And all this was going on, and we noticed there was a boat out there, and they'd either forgotten or they'd dropped the oars, so they had no means of propelling it. And they came up to us and said, "Can you give us a hand?" And we said, "Well, our boat, which was a Newfoundland dory, a good boat, it was covered in snow, and it would take, you know, literally hours to get it out." And what next? We said we'd go down and help them. We couldn't do much because we didn't have much, any implements at all. And then as the weather did often and caught you out, it suddenly changed and got worse. And before very long, it was around in a blizzard. And there was a chap there, a Bempo, I think his name was. He's a nice chap, big, strong chap, who wanted to be a ballet dancer. And he was in the boat, and we'd forgotten about him, which was rapidly going out to sea. And he had this, and at the same time, the visibility was deteriorating. Well, we phoned Jack, Sackfids, and they phoned their real base and told them the situation. And I thought, and it got worse and worse, and it was also getting dark, and I thought, that's the end of that chap. But myself, Hugh and Mike Ruby, we managed to free the dory and go after him in the boat, but it soon became apparent that their boat was much lighter than ours and we weren't catching up. So when this was happening, we had to turn around because we were going out. And our base leader phoned up at Port Stanley and said, "Look, this is the situation." And they got a classic telegram back, "Tell them to stop it and come inside." He obviously didn't have a clue. He thought they were fooling him. And in no time at all, it was just about dark, and it was this horrible blizzard blowing, and we thought, that's it. And then we went in, and as we were getting stuff together and wondering what to do next, which was very little, two helicopters came out of the gloom. And they were, it was an incredible piece, I thought, of airship, no, seamanship, whatever it is.
Airmanship.
Yeah. Bempo had the sense to lie down in, I think he had a bit of a canvas. He had the sense to lie down in the bottom of the boat, and that was it. Then they tied up for the night with the helicopters because they couldn't do anything more. And we thought, that's definitely it. And then came the first bright break of day. The Argentinians got away, the two helicopters. And below me, they found the boat and they found the chap, and he was okay. It's chance of survival normally, I would say, are a few thousand to one.
So we spent the entire night in an open boat?
In an open boat, yes.
Waiting for dawn when the helicopters could fly to get him.
Yeah.
And they were Argentinian helicopters,
yes,
right? An Argentinian ship. Have they come from an Argentinian ship or another base?
I think it would have been a ship.
Yeah.
Because they had ships down there.
He was a lucky man, wasn't he?
He was. I often wonder what became of him, whether he made it to his brother.
He became a ballet dancer.
Ballet dancer, yeah. Stranger things have happened.
What about yourself, Roger? Was there any moment when you thought your number was up?
Not really. I was once on a slope in the summer in South Georgia. It was one of the islands, and there was a lot of detritus. The rocks were crumbling, were very soft, and there was a bit like in that. Oh, you haven't seen it. There's a base. There's a photograph, and at the base of the cliffs, there's a whole lot of detritus. And it started to give under me. And I thought this was a bloody stupid thing to do. And I had to make up my mind quick whether to try and go back or go forward, and then decide to go forward. The rest is history.
And you fell down a crevasse at one point, is that right?
Oh, yeah, I didn't. I think
you didn't mention that just now.
Well, we were taking Graham Hobbs, who was a geologist. He wanted to go to a point which is the furthest point in the island. And we got there, there was this glacier which was not very big, and we were going along. We didn't want to have to make detours all the time, so we were keeping as far as possible to the coast and taking it in turns. And I was leading that day. It was a funny sensation. I was leading that day, and suddenly it was like there was nothing there, because there wasn't anything there. It just
went.
And Hugh, who was behind me, said afterwards, one minute I was there going along. I was lucky because I had skis. Oh, that could have been a nuisance. If the skis had jammed, it could have been a hell of a job getting them out, getting me as well. But anyhow, Hugh and Graham Hobbs got a line to me, and they were able to, with my own help. Well, the first thing I did was get rid of the ski bindings. And then once I had those off, they fell away. I was able.
Were you wedged, or were you on a ledge?
No, I was wedged. We were going by, as I say, we were going following the coast, basically.
Did you think you would get out, or was there a moment when you thought perhaps?
No, I didn't. I thought there was no. It didn't feel right. Just let it go. We didn't. There were quite a few people over the years lost on Fiji and crevasses, but no, as far as I know, at Hope Bay when I was there.
But when you went down the crevasse itself, you just knew you'd be able to get out again.
Yeah, it might have been ridiculous optimism on my part, but it was the whole thing. It wasn't like sort of I felt. This isn't true, somebody's got the wrong cards. Because he just went like that. So it was so easily done that I thought it must be as easily
to get back up. How long were you down there for?
Oh, by the time they went back and got some ropes and things, I think it's about 4 hours. It wasn't
that long. How much was that? Okay. We talked briefly about dogs, but you obviously, like most Fids, you were very fond of your dogs you had at Hope Bay. And you were suggesting that perhaps the presence of dogs made a base a happier base. Is that how you feel about it?
It seems to me that I think the trouble with the bases, most of them, is intimacy. You're all close together for the best part of a winter at least, and invariably. You have that reminds me of that photograph that Moore's just brought in. I didn't know whether you saw the figure at the bottom. There's a figure that was Dick Walcott, and I spent a month in one tent with him, and it was Dick who was kind of reckoned there was no point in the. It wasn't having the tent blowing over.
Tell me about your dogs. Who was your leader?
And well, what the devil was that you want to say?
Is this Vander?
No, Vander was a bit of lark. The best dog, without any doubt, that always getting past it when I was there, was Spark.
Spark.
Spark, yeah, and he. He was very intelligent, and he got in the end. He was always in fights when he was younger, but as he got older, he was more circumspect. But he knew the routes to various places, and he knew he would often wait when we were harnessing up for going to View Point, which, as I say, was about 20 miles down the road. Mm-hmm. The dogs would all get excited because it was a good free run and there was seal and everything laid on. And Spark had seen it all, and he got in the end. If he saw we were going out, he would lurk away out of sight and wait until the sledge. We'd wait for him and in the end get impatient and say, and clear off. And when we were gone, Spark would... been in hiding, would appear, and he didn't have to pull the sledge then, because it's gone over the hill. But Vander, for some reason, Vander couldn't produce much in the way of dogs, and she only produced one dog in the whole
pup.
And
that was Pongo.
Pongo, yeah. And he did his best, but he used to run alongside and he didn't bother to pull at all. I think he thought you were out there for fun. And he never wandered far or did anything. And this one evening, I think it might have been Fritz, people used to go up to the... What's the name of the place? It was the place we used to go and we used to make ice observations. At the top of the hill. It was 433, I think. 433 metres. And Pongo would go about as far as that. He was black and brown, a bit of all sorts, long legs, stupid. But he used to hang around. And on this evening, somebody had been going up to the bay, up to the hill for the ice op. And either Pongo followed them or not, I can't remember, but he fell into this piece of... It's known, in glaciology, as a Pongo. Pongo is a certain form of crevasse which forms when it collapses, I think. Anyhow, he managed to fall in when all the others were... had been back and forth across the way for God knows how many times. But We all got out, had to get all, it was just too far to get out easily. And we had to get all our stuff out, and they were cursing with ropes and crampons and that. And I can't remember whether we got him out or whether he got him out of his own accord, but we managed to get him out one way or the other. And he spent the rest of his days, as far as I know, looking after Pongo. But that was Vanda. It was a rather stupid dog. Then there was
about the beautiful one.
Yeah, I've forgotten. And there was a very beautiful fur, like a fox fur.
It was unusual for Fids in your day to spend 3 winters in the Antarctic, but yet you did. Was there a specific reason, or was it just circumstance?
I think it's mainly circumstance. But I did, I spent the early part of this telling you that I had nowhere in particular in the career to go. I hadn't got very far. I was enjoying myself, so I decided to stay on. That was basically it.
But did Fids take some persuading, because it was unusual?
Not that I know. I don't know what happened behind the scenes, as it were. I think quite a few people have done it now. I may be wrong there, but I think quite a few.
Let's move on and talk a little bit now about a chap called Major Bill Tillman, who was an adventurer both in the Antarctic and the Arctic, with a reputation, say the least. He had a boat called Mischief.
That's right.
How did you first come across him?
Well, he was, first of all, he was a mountaineer, and he was in charge of the 1938 Everest expedition as a climber, of course. They didn't get very far because the weather was pretty bad, but that's by the way. Then he went through the war and a number of things. He was fighting with the Yugoslavs in Yugoslavia from 1944. I think he's got a book on that. Trying to think. Anyhow, he'd been in the artillery in the First World War, and in the Second World War he was getting a bit past it, I think.
But how did you meet him?
Well, he was known in climbing circles, as these things are when people are known for unusual things or something. And Lee Rice, who was in Hope Bay with me, he was a keen sailor and had his own yacht. And Lee always dreamed of going round the world. And we hummed, and he asked me if we'd like to go with him. We hummed and hard about this. And he had a copy of Yachting Monthly sent to him. And he said that if Tillman was thinking of going on any long distance cruise again, let him know, and he might be prepared to go, have a crew. And I left it at that, and then just before Mischief came back from, we came back to Southampton, didn't we, in the Shackleton, and that was at the end of my third year. And then Tillman and then was off West Africa. Tillman sent a telegram saying, are either of you interested still in a long distance cruise? And that started, but Lee dropped out because he was going to be the surveyor, but he messed his ankle up. So I was left, and it was you get some weird fellows down in amongst on the dock side. In the Lee came, I came, a big lad called Jim. Can't remember, very strong, Jim he was called. There was a Dutchman called Jan. That was about it, I think.
And what was the expedition you joined?
Well, it wasn't an expedition at all, as such, really.
What was the trip you joined?
No, he, Tillman, actually, he was very cynical about these people who go out on special expeditions to collect flowers and things, you know. Tillman, there's a group of islands called the Crowsley Islands, and they were fairly common, used a lot in the 19th century because they were in the sailing ship tracks to Europe from around Australia. And these Crozet Islands reputedly had a mountain of 6,000 feet with glaciers. And Tillman tried to get there, and he couldn't land first because the boat was dismasted. So he went back to Cape Town, and Meyer letter awaited him. So he replied and said he'd go, but Lee, who was supposed to be coming with us, he didn't. So that was the background of that. And when we got Crozet Islands, in fact, they're quite, I don't know how you describe them. The climate's not unlike this. It's in the roaring 40s.
South of South Africa?
South of South Africa, yes, we call it.
And did you get there?
We got there, but we also lost out, because when we got there, the damn place was only 3,000 foot high. And we climbed it out of sheer cussiness. It was all like a walk. But that was the end of that. There's two factors at the event, which was, may or may not have had significance. Tillman had written to the what they call themselves, the Arctic Institute of the French Arctic Institute, something like that. And at the time we were going, before we left, of course, Tillman wrote and said, we're hoping to land on Crozet Island. And have you got any maps that you could let us have? And came a very snooty reply came back, who gave you permission? This is the French being snooty. And so, when we came back, as I say, we weren't there. But when the year after that, we discovered, and ever since, the French had put a base on it. They obviously thought the perfidious English were after something, and it's been there ever since. But we went on from there, further along in the Roaring Forties, to a place called Kerguelen, which was, well, French. There was a base there, and we had one there, and we called in and had a good meal, actually. And the other one was in a completely different hemisphere. In the Arctic, there was a mountain called Mount Raleigh, and no one had climbed it as far as we know. And it was quite different. It wasn't really a hard to climb, but it wasn't all that easy, because you had to land on the seashore, lug your stuff up. And so the thing was, it was a big ravine in between. And Tillman had a map with Mount Raleigh on that side, and I had a map with Mount Raleigh on the other side. Well, they couldn't both be right. So we thought we've got to do something to show ourselves. So we decided to climb both of them to make certain.
Oh, there were two mountains, but you didn't know which was which.
One was definitely higher than the other. Mm. So we climbed both. That was the last trip I had with Tillman.
And you also did a final trip with Hugh Simpson up into the Arctic Circle, didn't you? When he was still carrying on with his physiological tests on you.
Well, I did a number with you. I when Nansen wanted to cross Greenland at the time, nobody had done so, and there were all sorts of theories. Did he have an ice cap? What was the snow like? And I knew what Nansen wanted to do, because he said it tells you in his book. But he couldn't do it because he couldn't get in at the time. It was ice again. He finally got in right towards the end of the season, but went at a chunk, as it were, cut a slice off and climbed over the ice cap and down. And my plan was to use Nansen's plan and see if we can do, because it hadn't been done anyhow. Who wants to cross Greenland? Anyhow, we did that. We climbed further up the coast and we did this crossing where the Americans have an ice... They have a big base now called Thule. And that was another set of views. I'm trying to think what...
Did he manage it?
We managed it, yeah. He managed it easily. I was annoyed because I'd worked it out and I knew we could do it. But they said, you have your food supplies, which was ridiculous. It was somebody who never thought things out. And in fact, we had, I don't know how much food left when we finished.
Let's wind up, if we may, then, Roger. Did you actually... you talked about not having a career in mind when you were doing all this adventuring. Did you actually get a career in the end?
I never found it, no.
You didn't get a career?
No.
So how have you spent the last 60 years?
That's a secret. I was in teaching mainly.
Oh, I see.
The great thing about teaching, or you could in those days, there were always jobs going at one time. So as long as you didn't mind particularly what you were doing, you couldn't do it.
How does your... Looking back over the life you've led so far, how highly does the Antarctic rate in your life story?
Oh, very highly. In front of anything else. There's a purity about the Antarctic. And funnily enough, it never occurred to me to feel other than safe there. Providing you don't do anything stupid, it's probably one of the safest places in the world to travel. If you need food, you can get it on the fringes. As long as you don't try and do too much. If you're skiing, you've got your tent with you. If you keep to these rules, like always never separate from your tent and always keep some food, that sort of fundamental basic thing, very difficult to go wrong. And of course, the wildlife is so wonderful. You can literally walk up the things. Penguins pat them on the head. They don't like it, but they think like that.
So it was a special time, was it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And of course, as you say, it's gone now. I suppose every generation says that, but I think we were the last generation. You were saying earlier about career. Nobody took themselves very seriously there, I don't think. A few doctors or a few people who were doing research in medicine were doing something. But there's a whole lot of people who came down, for want of a better word, for the fun of it.
Mm. Was it fun for you?
Yes, I think so. I've lost track with a whole lot of people, of course. I suppose that's inevitable in life. Oh, I know, or perhaps I shouldn't say this now, but the thing I was going to say that put me off Don McCalman, he was following us on base, and Mike Ruby. And they had to shoot some dogs, and Don shot them before we left for the boat, which all he had to do was wait for a day, actually. And I thought, at the time, typical bloody Glaswegian. And I was so unnecessary to do it. And I think, honestly, I think Don couldn't see what the fuss was about. I don't think it was vindictiveness. He just couldn't see what the fuss was about. Mm.
Let's leave it there, Roger.
Yeah, right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.